I know.
Yeah. Fuck, that's really cool.
Yeah, I was like, I had no idea, but I'm like, that's pretty cool. I was like, did you get to meet Jack White? And he's like, yeah, probably. That was when I was drinking a lot. You know, he's sober now, but
yeah.
It's like, damn.
damn. Cool guy. Alrighty, guys, welcome back to another episode of Flip the Record. This is a football fan's guide to Taylor Swift, episode 4, covering Red today. Interesting album, and I'll do a little preamble here, and then we'll get into the nonsense that I'd like to cover since it's been a few weeks, but this is a bold statement from Taylor. She's one album of the year doing country music. She's done 3 country music albums, let's say, and this is not a full break from the action, but is a significant break from that country scene. There's a lot of pop songs on here, like full-blown pop songs, which is... At this point in her career, I think in retrospect, this album has garnered a lot of acclaim, and like Taylor fans fucking love this album. But I think at the time, it wasn't like the most favorite thing for Taylor fans. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's crazy that at this point in her career, too, she's only like 21 years old.
Yeah. 21, well, 22, but you know.
Well, when she started writing some of the songs.
Right. And, you know, 4 albums in already. That's actually a crazy point. But it's kind of the first note, at least in my, and this is very much a retrospective tape, but in my opinion, this is the first note of her being like, fuck it. I'm the star here. I'm going to do what I think is best.
Mm-hmm.
Which is hard. It's really fucking hard. Especially when you've been so kind of nourished and grown by the media that supports your country music. And to now say, I'm going over to 98.7 as opposed to 99.5.
Yeah. Local radio reference.
Yeah,
going from country to pop.
Right. It's bold, man. But it's so in character for her now in retrospect. And there's still a lot of really good stuff on here, and I'm excited to get into this today.
Absolutely.
All right, so other topics that we should cover, kind of a look back at the last few weeks in music. Let me pull up my notes here. But the first one that strikes me right off the top is the rap beef of the decade. Kendrick Lamar versus Drake and J. Cole.
Yeah, I'm pulling up. Give me a sec. I'm going to pull up the lyrics.
Yeah, so I'll just get into it a little bit then. We talked a little bit on the Vance Joy episode about how J. Cole and Kendrick have been, or maybe not them necessarily, but there's been rumors of a J. Cole and Kendrick collab album for upwards of a decade.
Yeah, so this was like around the time of Born Sinner, Good Kid, Mad City, after both those albums that came out.
Yeah, so a decade, maybe plus.
Yeah, in that they were in the studio recording a bunch of songs together, about to do a collab album. I believe this was also around the time of Wash the Throne came out, so that was a collab album with Jay-Z and Kanye. There were rumors of a Drake and Lil Wayne collab album that never came out, although they've done a million songs together.
Yeah.
But this was like the time when collab albums were hot in the streets, and this was like two of the top 3 or 4 hottest rappers in the game.
That's an important point to make here. These are the named big 3.
Cream of the crop.
Yeah. And
self-named and also named by fans and critics alike. Like I think everyone is in synchrony and saying like at this point in time, like these are the 3.
Whether or not
guys.
You agree with that, the public sentiment is that these are the big 3 in hip hop.
Yes.
Since the early 2010s. We've come a long way since then. J. Cole's put out some projects. Kendrick's put out some projects, but there's...
And Drake puts out a project every year.
Yeah, so that's the interesting bit. So J. Cole and Kendrick have been slowly putting projects out. I would say since To Pimp a Butterfly, you had Damn pretty quickly, and then Mr. Morale and the Big Steppers took a long time to get there.
Yeah,
In between, he had the Black Panther album, and then a couple other, you know, he's jumped on tracks, and he's done a couple singles, but there's a lot of time between Mr. Morale and Damn.
Yeah, Damn came out in 2017, Mr. Morale and the Big Steppers 2022.
And similarly, Kendrick, or J. Cole, since KOD, which came out, what, 2018, 2019?
Pulling it up.
Yeah, so, and J. Cole hasn't put out, he's been teasing The Fall Off, which is going to be the next album, since KOD.
Well, so KOD came out in 2018. He did put out Revenge of the Dreamers, which is...
Again, it's a studio work. Or I guess like a collab album between all the different rappers on his label.
Yeah, and then The Offseason came out in 2021. But I will say where J. Cole is different from Kendrick is J. Cole's hopped on dozens of features, and he's killed, like, all of them. Like, feature J. Cole is... J. Cole on a feature is just... I could list off, like, 20 songs right now where it's just gas.
Yeah, for sure. And Kendrick, I'm not going to take that away from him either. There's lots of, like, strange tracks that he jumps onto that I'm like, damn, Kendrick killed this one.
But Kendrick,
not as much, though.
I was going to say, for every five features J. Cole does, you might get one Kendrick feature.
Right, that's a great point.
And,
so,
and Drake is on the other spectrum of, he releases an album, mixtape, / project once a year. Is on a million features. He's all over the place.
It's a bit like he's Call of Duty, and these guys are, I don't know,
Battlefield.
Yeah. So, you know, you got that aspect to this. So let's skip ahead to, what was it, last year? Drake puts out his album For All the Dogs. On that album, you have First Person Shooter, which is a J. Cole feature. And Drake and J. Cole both basically say, like, hey, listen, we're the best in the game right now. I know people are talking about a big three, but like they both separately say like I'm the best in the game. And don't really
while J. Cole also does acknowledge in the song who is the big three? Is it Aubrey or K-Dot or me? So he at least acknowledges.
Yeah, he acknowledges it.
They are the big three, but to your point, they do both kind of say like, well, I'm number
one. And I think
one.
J. Cole, in my opinion, on that track, it gets a bit of a pass in my opinion because he acknowledges it, and it doesn't seem that crazy to me to. If you're a rapper, like, yeah, you're the best in the game. Like, you're not going to say, like, oh, you know what? Yeah, Kendrick's pretty good. Like, I'd probably put him ahead of me. Nobody's going to say that. Whereas Drake just, like, says it without acknowledging Kendrick. So that, I give J. Cole a bit of a pass
and
there.
And there's two other songs in J. Cole's discography. One on from 2014, Forest Hills Drive, where he says, I just had it in my mind, too. It's Porn Center. The difference between the Pretenders and the Kendrick Lamars. So like he acknowledges Kendrick's like one of the real ones. He does it again on one of his later albums. So like that's three separate times where he's like saying like Kendrick Lamar is a real one. Like I fuck with this guy, I respect this guy.
They've been friends, dude. When we saw the Damn Tour in 2016, 2017, Kendrick brought J. Cole out on stage to do J. Cole songs.
Yeah, that was sweet.
That was sick.
Surprise appearance too.
Shocker.
Yeah.
And so naturally, like it makes sense that they're good and everything's cool. And then I think when you go back to First Person Shooter, it doesn't shock me that he like acknowledges Kendrick and then says, "Yeah, I'm the best in the game." Like that seems like friendly competition to me. Whereas Drake seems a little bit like, "Ah, fuck you." Drake has been bodied in a lot of, well, maybe not a lot, but most recently I can think of, he's been bodied by Pusha T and had no response for Pusha T in that beef. And he's ready to do it again, but now he's going after Kendrick.
But he did body Meek Mill.
That was a long time ago, brother. That was 10 years ago.
Yeah, but still.
But he got bodied by Pusha T, and now he's going after maybe the best lyricist of our time.
But he's not
in hip-hop?
But not in a very direct way. Like there's some,
yeah, which is part of the problem for Kendrick.
Yeah. The sneak dissing.
Yeah, the sneak dissing.
And there are I watched a breakdown video of like someone dissecting lines from like all three of these guys throughout last like 15 years. So there's certainly lines Drake has where you could say like, "Oh, that's a sneak diss
Kendrick,
to Kendrick."
Yeah,
so it's there, but you do have to, it's not like you have to dig for it. It's not out there in the open.
So you got that. A couple weeks ago, I want to say, 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Three.
Future puts out a new album, and he gets Kendrick on
Metro Boomin. With Metro Boomin.
Future and Metro Boomin, they work together all the time.
Yeah.
So they get Kendrick on a track, and the beat is fucking fire on
the
this
beat,
track.
Dude, the beat is insane on
Unreal.
This track.
Unreal. And it goes even harder, like... Oh, dude, the number of TikToks I've seen where it's like Future's on the verse and he's like, Metro, where the fuck was this beat when I was on it? Because like the beat's good, but then it kicks up to 11 when Kendrick gets on the track.
Yeah. Dude,
Kendrick drops an absolute burner on the mic. I mean, scorches these motherfuckers.
Well, and his emotion, like you can hear like the anger and like the emotion in his voice. And it's a fire verse.
And so that's where I think. I think he was mad at Drake, but then J. Cole, like, did it, and he was like, yeah, fuck you, too. And, you know, like, He doesn't give a damn. So he gets in there, absolutely cooks Drake and J. Cole.
But it's more so, I do want to, I say, it's he's more so cooking Drake, because there's some lines in
here.
Okay, and let me just say this, because these are very Drake-specific lines that are really good lines, where he's saying, I got the verse, I'm just scrolling through it. DOT, the money, power, respect, the last one is better. That's more so towards Drake, because, you know, he's saying, I've got the respect of the industry, Drake's, you know, whatever. Drake's just like a pop kind of guy.
Yeah.
And then the one for Drake and J. Cole is, motherfuck the big three, fool, it's just me, fool.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the one where it's specific to Drake is, in your best work is a light pack, fool, Prince outlived Mike Jack, comparing himself to Prince, which he did on Mask Off remix featuring Future back in the day.
Yeah, right.
And Drake to Michael Jackson is like, yeah, Michael Jackson was like the king of pop, and he had all these number one hits, but real critics and real fans respect Prince's work more. It's kind of what it is.
Yeah, that's the comparison for sure.
So, and then, too, sorry, one more thing real quick. This is a direct one. For All Your Dogs Getting Buried, that's the name of Drake's project.
Yeah.
That's a K with all these nines. He can see Pet Cemetery, which is a killer line.
Fire. Like I said, debatably the best lyricist in hip-hop of our generation.
Yeah.
Cooks, Drake, and to part J. Cole. So people are like, Cole, you got to get in the studio and say something, man. Like, and Drake, too, like. You guys aren't going to let this slide, are you? And I think Cole kind of like hesitantly was like, fine, fuck it. I'll clap back. So he comes back with a surprise, like 12-person mixtape. I think it's a mixtape.
12-track mixtape.
Yeah, yeah.
Might delete later.
Yeah.
And the last song on the mixtape is the response to Kendrick.
7-minute drill. It's only a 3.5-minute song, but that's beside the
point.
Well,
so the name of the song, 7-Minute Drill, is because what him and his producers do sometimes is they do 7 minutes to make the beat and then 7 minutes to write the lyrics is like a...
Okay, yeah. Like
it's actually kind of
an exercise.
It's a cool concept.
Yeah, it's fun.
So that's the name of the song.
Beat on this one's pretty fire, too. Not quite the same as the Metro Boomin beat. But I think Cole kind of cooks here, too. It's not... But it's different because KDOT was like, ah, fuck these guys. If I burn the bridge, so be it. Cole takes a more nuanced approach where he definitely digs at Kendrick, but he says a few times in the songs, like, I like this guy. Like, I don't know what we're doing here. I don't really want to, like, I don't want to bury him, but if I have to, I will.
Yeah, he acknowledges the respect for... He called Good Kid, Mad City a classic, said Damn was Kendrick's prime, but then he also, like, says...
Yeah, he dissed To Pimp a Butterfly, which is critically acclaimed as one of the greatest hip-hop albums of all time.
Dude, it might be the wackest diss I... Like, to diss To Pimp a Butterfly is universally regarded as one of the best rap albums of all time. And, you know, he said it was overrated, but it helped win Kendrick a Pulitzer Prize. Like...
A Pulitzer for a rap album.
Yeah.
That's insane. That's such a bad, like, dig. Like, if you want to go after something, go after Mr. Morale.
100%.
Not a great album. And he did. He mentions it in the track. It's not a great album in the general view. But what are you doing going after that track, that album?
You know what was crazy? Is I was so triggered online. I went on Twitter, and there was a lot of people that were like, hidden in the bushes in the shadows, waiting, ready to drag onto Pimp a Butterfly. Like, yeah, this was some weak shit. People have been hiding in the bushes for 10 years, waiting to drag this album. Like, I did not.
What are we talking about?
I know, like.
What are we talking about?
And I talked to my one friend Reed about this, and he was like, well, I think with To Pimp a Butterfly, he's like, don't get me wrong, it's a great album, but there's some songs on the album that just don't have this.
Like standing there's, power. Yeah, I know what you mean.
And they have some energy. The energy is a little bit lower, and that's kind of why he's like, I understand why Cole might say it would put people to sleep.
Except also, Cole, you have the same problem. If you really want to, if that's the avenue you want to take, we can go song for song, buddy. Because you don't have an album that critically acclaimed, but you have the same problem. There are plenty of J. Cole songs that find their way to be a bit underwhelming. Like,
sure.
In terms of replay, you know, staying power.
Yeah.
And so, it felt like to me, like, he didn't want to do it, and he was just trying to, like, dip a toe in the water and be like, hey, motherfucker, I got some stuff, but like, I'm not going to kill you here. Which I mentioned to you the other day. I wish, I guess that's not a good way of putting it, but like, I feel if you're going to dip a toe in the water, you might as well jump in the pool. And I understand he clearly states why he doesn't want to do that. I get it. You like Kendrick, you respect him as an artist, fine. But dipping a toe in the water makes you look like a little bit like a bitch.
Especially
when you got cooked.
I disagree. I don't know. I think it's one, it's a if I'm truly going to be like one of the best of the best, I can't just let this go, but I also respect this guy. I don't want to go out here and call him like a pussy and I don't want to go out here and say things that I don't necessarily mean.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say a couple things, some of which are outlandish. Saying To Pimp a Butterfly is overrated, that's outlandish. But he also says, like, you know, you put out 4 albums in 12 years, I can divide, which that's a very real claim. Like, Kendrick hasn't been putting out music at a frequent rate.
How much have you been putting out, buddy?
He's put out more than Kendrick.
Not by much.
That's true. Not by much, but a little bit. But no, I don't mind the approach of saying, like, hey, these are warning shots. If you want to do this, I'll do it.
I hope Kendrick comes back.
Kendrick and Cole are my two favorite rappers of like the modern generation.
Yeah, yeah.
I would rather see Kendrick body Drake. I don't want to see Kendrick and Cole necessarily go at it. Although I'm not going to turn my head away. Like, I'm very entertained by it.
But I guess you're right, but I don't see Drake responding to this. I think Drake knows his place now. Drake got bodied, and it's just like the story of Adidon.
There is a picture of Kobe driving on Bron, and Bron's playing defense, and then there's a guy wearing a Kobe.
Yeah, I saw that.
It's like, this is Drake. Yeah. It's like Kendrick is Kobe, J. Cole is Bron, and then the guy wearing the
Kobe t-shirt, yeah.
Or yeah, actually, it would be the reverse. It'd be Cole would be Kobe, Kendrick would be Bron, and Drake would be wearing the Kobe shirt since J. Cole's like.
Yeah. Oh, man. Anyways, if this is any indication of a budding rivalry, then I'm hell. Oh, it's going to be an awesome summer, dude. Can't wait.
I do want to say I've never seen a tweet. I haven't had a tweet make me as angry in a long time. Someone tweeted, J. Cole is much closer to Logic than Kendrick Lamar.
Yeah, that's crazy.
My fist and my blood were boiling. Like, to say, it's just, that's so disrespectful.
That is very disrespectful.
And I like Logic.
I do too.
But there's levels to this thing.
Yeah.
And that ain't a good comparison of levels.
Now I'm getting boiled up a little bit.
And I do think, like, you can make an argument Kendrick's the best rapper of the last 10, 15 years. You can make an argument for even longer if you wanted. I think in the last, like, several years, you can make an argument J. Cole's in the top 3, like, of this generation or whatever you want to call it. Like, there's an argument to be made for Kendrick and Cole. I'd say less so Drake because he's got all the pop and R&B. But I don't know. Like, these guys are the point I'm trying to make is these guys are all at the top of the game.
I've seen some people arguing that Future deserves a spot in this category as well. To which I disagree, but I understand the point. Because Future's been putting out a lot of stuff, too. And actually, like collabing with Metro Boomin so often, he kills it. So I get it. What's going on here, brother?
That was blasphemous. Future is nowhere near that.
Yeah. It's not my favorite, but I do like Future. I don't know if he belongs in the same, like, Mount Rushmore as them.
No.
But I've heard the argument.
No.
Anyways. So that's been a fun thing lately. Second topic. Did you see R. Kelly is doing a collab project?
No.
Him and Diddy are getting in the studio and putting out fire.
That can't be real.
No, it's not. I just made it up. Yeah. It's just a point to say that Diddy's a piece of shit and he's going to jail forever.
I saw something. I didn't look it up or anything. Someone said that, because the tweet was really bad, but Diddy and Justin Bieber, like, that he violated Justin Bieber in some way?
I think that's a lot of projection, not projection, but like speculation. But the idea there is that basically, like, Diddy worked with Justin Bieber a lot, and now Diddy's being accused of pedophilia, and Justin Bieber's like 15 years old.
Gotcha.
So that's the speculation there. Yeah, Diddy might be going under the jail. Anytime you got to take a plane to somewhere that doesn't have extradition, probably getting put under the jail.
Yeah.
So, you know, good run, buddy. See you later. Completely separate topic. The Maggie Rogers, Bruce Springsteen, Zach Bryan collab at the Barclays, or maybe MSG. Awesome. I mean, that's one of those all-time live moments in a career. When you get those three people together, it's just like, wow. Like, I can't believe I was here for this.
Yeah, that's pretty epic.
It was so fucking cool. And it made me think, because I started – I saw that, and I started listening to a little bit more Zach Bryan after I saw that again. And I listened to his whole live album front to back. I think some of the live version of his songs are way better than the studio version. So, like, Revival. The live version on All My Homies Hate Ticketmaster, the live album, is like 11 minutes long. And it's, you know, it's a lot of crowd work and shit like that and repeating the chorus over and over and over. But I just like the energy so much more. On the album, it feels a little bit like homey, whereas live, he rips into it. And I noticed that with a bunch of other tracks where it just feels like he lets it all out in the live shows. In the studio, he's a bit more nuanced, a bit more like measured.
Yeah, I can get behind that take.
You know what I mean?
100%, yeah. I might tend to agree with you on that, yeah.
And there's even songs in the studio work where it's like, yes, yes, fucking do it. Like, Open the Gate in Studio Work is one of those songs that strikes me as like, yes, he let it rip. But there's a lot of other songs that are good in the studio, way better in the live version. Like Oklahoma City. He does a live version of Oklahoma City. And that's a fairly like sweet kind of like sad tinge of sadness song, but it sounds again, just him like getting really gritty and like ripping it off on the mic. God, it sounds good, man.
Yeah, I think we might be in the minority, but I love like when I really love an artist, like I'll download a live album and I might listen to the live album as much as or more than the studio version.
I was thinking about deleting some of the studio versions of the songs and just replacing them with the live versions.
Yeah, like I have some live albums throughout the years, like Linkin Park's Road to Revolution. I think that's the title. There's one from I really liked growing up from Simple Plan, where they do like all their hits from like the early 2000s. And I like that more than the studio version. But throughout the years, like, if you get the right energy on a live track, it can definitely be better than the studio stuff.
It just way outperforms. And it's fun, like, watching it happen, too. Like, if you see videos of him doing this stuff, it's so fucking cool, man. And, like,
yeah,
just putting yourself in that situation, like, listening to that live album. Because it's, like, literally after every song, he's like, I'm sorry it's so cold, Red Rocks. I'm going to keep going, though. Let's keep it up. And it's a funny little bit he does through the entire album. But, like, putting yourself in that situation where it is maybe, like, 10 degrees, snowing profusely, and you got Zach Bryan just, like, killing it and making his live album is so fucking cool, dude. Like,
yeah.
Oh, vibes. Anyways, yeah, it struck me really hard, and got me excited about Zach Bryan again.
I'm gonna have to listen to that album now.
Yeah, it's
like
awesome.
That.
There's a middle section that slows down a little bit, but you can go for the first 10, 11 tracks and then skip towards the end, and, like, that's the prime of it. Couple other things. What did I – oh, new 21 Pilots track.
Yeah, I didn't like that one as much as the first one.
I think I agree. It's a bit more like rocky. It's not heavy rock. It's very much like just solid rock. But it travels into a few different things. This is very 21 Pilots of them to like turn a kind of like almost like 70s, 80s rock song into this like kind of trippy, weird thing towards the end. It didn't lesser or expand my excitement for the new album, which comes out in about a month.
Their marketing budget's insane.
Yeah.
I was driving back from the airport, and they had, like, two or three billboards, like, the Clancy World Tour, and it's the picture of the album cover.
Yeah, it's going to be huge, dude. Yeah. It's going to be big, big, like, summer tour, like, one of the shows that people are going to fucking lose their minds for.
Yeah, and we're going.
We're going. Excited. Going to be a good time.
Yeah.
The last note I had, there's some other things that happened, but I listened back to the new Blink album again. Front to back. I don't know how that didn't win the fucking Grammy, the Rock Grammy. That's fucking crazy.
Over
Paramore?
Yeah, the one we talked about with Queens, Paramore, Greta, and then Metallica.
I don't know how it didn't win that Grammy. It's so fucking good, dude.
Did they classify it as something else, or they
no,
just didn't
it,
even...
I think it classified as rock, but like, it's my favorite of those albums by far, because like, listen, I like a lot of songs off the Foo Fighter album. I like a lot of songs off the Greta album. Didn't like the Paramore album, as we've talked about, and haven't really delved into the Metallica album. But
Queen's
album
was good, too.
And the Queen's album was really good. But, man, top to bottom, there's really not a skip on the Blink album, man. It's so fucking cool. And it's, like, it's got that, like, story to it that you would think lends itself to awards.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like the comeback, the all of them going through their own trials and tribulations.
You would think that would strike a chord with the Grammys. Like,
I don't
bored.
I don't think Blink is like ever looked at is in that light from like a critic's perspective, though.
Well, get fucked because they missed out.
I don't disagree.
Yeah,
I just don't think it's. I think
I know what you mean. They get taken as a bit of a sideshow, maybe because
exactly.
They are so goofy. But this was not a. There were goofy elements to it for sure. This is not a goofy album. This is a very like powerful album. And
I'm actually curious if they've won a Grammy now.
I would doubt it.
Yeah, me too.
Because like even in their prime, they were going up against some heavy hitters still.
They got They got a nomination for California. That's their only nomination was for California.
God,
what a slap in the face.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying, dude. So like. Like
I mean, that
early,
was a good album.
Early 2000s, they're going up against big hitters, and I think Foo Fighters has won like a million Grammys.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's a tough nut to crack, but you know, it's no shame that you fall second to Foo Fighters.
True.
Anyways, yeah, I was just shocked. Anyways,
you know what's funny though? I think if you'd ask each of those three guys, Adam, Tom, and
I
don't think they would. Yeah, exactly. I don't think they'd care in the slightest.
They're making money hand over fist, and then they're having fun doing it.
They're doing what they love
yeah.
with their friends. Yeah, I don't think they care at all.
Yeah, yeah, it's just a blip on the radar.
They'd probably moon everyone at the Grammys or something stupid too, like give everyone the finger or something.
I hear
know.
That. Yep. 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 Alrighty, that's the limit of my list so far. So if you want to get into Red, let's do it.
Yeah, so I've got a couple statistics about the success of the album. I'm going to rattle these off. Feel free to interject as you see fit. Red sold 1.2 million copies in its debut week, which was more than any other album since 2002, where Eminem sold 1.32 million copies of the Eminem Show.
Oh, that's a big deal.
Yep. This also meant Taylor became the first woman to have 2 million selling weeks since SoundScan started keeping track of album sales in 1991 with Speak Now and then obviously this album. The Red album topped the sales charts in 42 countries. That's actually pretty crazy too.
Yeah.
42 countries. Like
that's huge. That's a lot of fucking
that's
countries.
A lot of countries.
Yeah.
That's like, I'm trying to do the math. Like what percentage of countries
I think
that is.
Like
but
25% of countries or something.
No,
maybe
I think there's like
20%?
250 countries.
Oh,
or
is there
like
one?
That.
Whatever.
But regardless. Yeah. Yeah, so those are there's more, but those are some of the good ones.
And it's the first one she remade. It's the first one that was the Taylor's version. So maybe this is a good time to mention this. So we've talked about it to some extent. She was in a recording kind of master's deal where she didn't own the rights to her music. That's not uncommon for artists. We've talked about this before. At some point, she gets into a spat with the recording label and the studio that owns the masters sells the masters to Scooter Braun, who's this like kind of big music executive douchebag, without offering her the sale. They sell it to him without offering it to her. She goes to him and is like, hey, I'd like to buy my masters. And he basically says, get fucked. Mine now. And I think he might also be... Scooter Braun might also be backed by George Soros or something. Like, one of those, like, weird, like, tycoons.
Yeah.
Which is a strange side note, but he basically says, get fucked. This is a gold mine. Mine now.
Yeah. My grandchildren's grandchildren are going
to
be...
I literally don't have to do anything except own this.
Eating off a gold platter.
Yeah, exactly. So after a lot of back and forth and public strife about this... She says, fuck you. I'm just going to re-record everything, and then nobody's going to listen to your shit. So have fun with that. And then so she announces at one of her concerts, like, hey, Red's coming out. I'm doing it again. Bonus tracks, new tracks, old tracks. I'm doing it all. Which we've said before is such a masterstroke of business, dude. It's so fucking cool.
I don't know. I didn't look into, like, the legality of it at all, but I'm surprised that she was, like, legally allowed to do that.
Well, so owning the masters means you own the physical recordings of that music. You don't own the songs, you own the recordings. So, like, it's exactly this scenario where, like, if the artist wants to go back and do it again, sure, go nuts. But that's taking away from your ability to make new music.
Yeah.
In just in terms of, like, time spent, you know?
I think for her...
Yeah, and there's not a lot of artists that have the acclaim that could do this.
Yeah, not only the acclaim, but she has, like, if a standard album of hers has, like, 15 tracks, the bonus version has another 5 to 7.
And this one's double.
And then, yeah, and she also had, like, another 5 to 10 to 15 songs that she recorded and just never released. So she had these ones in the vault that were, like, ready to go.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of the genius of it, too, is, like, she was always recording, like, 2 albums worth of content. And then, like, just having that all in, like, the bag.
Ready to rock. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, like, okay, fans aren't going to be upset that, well, one, it's not even like she stopped putting out new music, because she's still putting out new music. But even if the rate of new music slowed, which it didn't really that much, she's putting out another, like, half album, album's worth of content of, like, old songs, which is really cool.
She's been good for a new album every 2-3 years for a long time. And that cadence hasn't stopped, regardless of the fact that she's got, like, 4 or 5 Taylor's versions out now.
Which, honestly, is, like, just the work ethic is impressive.
On top of the fact that she's touring like a fucking maniac.
Yeah.
You know,
just going grinding
all over the place. Actually, that reminds me of a fun scenario I had. If there was a Lions NFC Championship game in Detroit tomorrow, and then next weekend there was a Taylor Swift Eras Tour date in Detroit, which would get more, like, buzz in the city? Which would draw more people, the Lions NFC Championship game or the Taylor Swift Eras Tour back in Detroit next weekend?
I do think you get extra people for the championship game that just want to be in the city and feel the energy, go to bars, restaurants. Whereas if you're not going to, you're either going to the concert or you're not. You're not going to go down to Detroit and go to a local bar or whatever to soak up the energy.
I wonder about that. Because you remember when they came last year, it was like, if you're not going to the show, avoid it. Avoid the city at all costs. But then, like, the city, like, there were so many people who didn't get into the show that were also there. Like, I knew a woman who was bringing her 4 kids. Or she brought, like, her kid and a couple other kids.
$1,000. Oh, like, to the concert outside?
No. So she bought the tickets for her kids who were, like, teenagers. Or not her kids, but, like, her kid and the friends. And the wives, the mothers, just stayed in the city. You know, waited for the show to be over, picked them up, da-da-da. I don't think it's that crazy. Like, yes, I do think the NFC Championship game would draw more people. But I do think it creates a very similar, like, level of buzz.
Yeah.
And maybe we're in a unique situation because, like, the Lions have been so bad that it would literally draw everybody who could be there. But maybe in another city, like, I don't know, like Denver. Like, if Denver had the Eras Tour versus, like, an NFC champ or AFC Championship game, like, is that a comparable thing? Like, which is, it's just illustrating the point to how fucking crazy that tour was.
Yeah. You're probably right.
I don't think I'm too far off.
Yeah, I think it's city dependent, but I think you bring up the argument that it could vary from city to city.
Yeah, and it's good context for the football listeners. Anyways, but yeah, this album, we said at the top, it's groundbreaking, it's different, it's vibrant and powerful. You know, the storytelling again here is so powerful. It's very similar to the last album in terms of the storytelling. On the bonus edition of this album, she has like a 30-minute spoken word bit at the end where she's like, you know, this is an album about a time I was going through a lot of, like, relationship heartbreak and change and struggle in my life, and I just hope you guys really enjoy this as much as I did.
Yeah.
And that sums it up perfectly. I think this is a super cool name for an album, especially given the title track, Red. I love the artwork on both covers of this album, the original and the Taylor's version. I think having that bright red lipstick on kind of like a faded, obscured, like, picture of her, but the lipstick is so, like, prominent, is a cool bit. And then on the Taylor's version, I think you see her wearing a scarf, which is which is a funny little reference. Maybe not. No, it's just a trench coat, but that actually would have been a good little touch.
Yeah, for the All Too Well. Yeah, for
yeah,
sure.
For All Too Well, which is probably now the biggest hit off this album.
Yeah, 100%.
It's a masterstroke. I've said that pretty much every time we've talked. Maybe not the first album, but so fucking good, dude. And, you know, some of the pop stuff's not necessarily for me. It's very girl power, like, it's just not, you know, straight white males are not the intended audience. but that's not to take away from the validity and power of some of these tracks as well.
Or just the sheer popularity. And
right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's all I got as a preamble. Unless you got anything else, let's get into it.
Yeah, so Red opens with State of Grace, which is a good, like, it's almost kind of like a U2, like, pop rock sound. I don't know if that's a good comp.
No, I think that is a good rock. That's a good comp. I had 2000s pop rock.
Okay, yeah. But yeah, it's a cool song. It serves as like a warning for, you know, how love can be amazing and devastating at the same time. It can go both ways. She wrote this about when you first fall in love with someone, just the possibilities and thinking of different ways where it can go. And I think it's a great opener.
And she busts down the door right away into that pop sound. I'm not sure it's what the casual to excited listener was expecting at all. I don't think there was any like notion that she was putting out a pop album. It just happened. And so to get this on the first track is a very direct, like, hey, this is what we're doing now. This is what I'm interested in. And I think it's a great open, honestly. It's not my favorite song on the album by far, but I think it's a really cool open. Like you said, a couple guitars kind of ripping jangly mid-tune chords, bumping keyboards, setting the pace underneath, drawn out vocals, but like without any twang and a very like radio-friendly kind of pop sound to it. It's a great open.
Yeah, 100%. The next song, title track, Red. This is one of my favorite Taylor Swift songs, one of my favorites from this album. This is a really cool song.
I think it's an important song to have here, too, because you could take the context of Red a few different ways, but I think she very clearly defines what she means by, like, I felt red. It's a great analogy. It's very approachable, very understandable, and clear to the listener. Like it was the greatest of times. It was the worst of times.
Yeah, and in the simplest form, red is the color of it's the color of your heart and love, and it's also the color of blood and pain.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. That's the analogy she's trying to portray on this song. And I think it's important. It came at this early in the album. To put this at 7 or 8 wouldn't make much sense to me. And it's got a little bit of the nod to the country fans. After you've missed the first song from the country aspect, you get a little bit more country on this. It's still poppy. You get a little bit of that, like, mic feedback on the last line of the chorus where she's like, everything was red, which is a very pop thing to do. But the chord structure and the drums are very much more, like, solidified in the country sound. And so you get that mix, which is a nice like throwback. You even get a little banjo in here. Everything you said, I really like this song too. It's not one of my favorites, but I really do like this song.
And I think where Taylor Swift is so masterful is taking an idea like something as simple as colors and then just doing it as well as you can do it. Because there's so many ways that you could make singing about different colors and emotions sound dumb. But the way that she does it, where losing him was blue like I'd never known, missing him was dark gray all alone, forgetting him was like trying to know someone you never met, but loving him was red. Like, it's sweet, simple, but it's masterful. Like, it's well done.
That would have been a funny, like, USS album where they just did, like, the 7 colors of the rainbow and made that an album.
I mean, but do you get what I'm saying, though? Where, like, you could eat, like, it's very easy for someone to take that idea and just mess it up.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was getting at. That's why I said she so masterfully explains the concept here.
Yeah.
Yeah, agreed. Great song, great second track here. Next one, Treacherous. Quieter, kind of simple, sad girl pop rock here. This is a little bit more akin to like the more modern Taylor Swift, I would say. Not so folky as it is, but it still falls into that like sad girl music kind of feel. Easy high-tune acoustic strumming mixed with banjo on the verses. Electric guitar switches out the banjo in the chorus. Hand cymbals and claps driving the beat. A big crescendo at the end. I like this one.
Yeah, it's one of the more like overtly sexual songs,
which is strange.
Yeah, and this one was. There's a few different guys on the album that have inspiration for songs, but this one is most likely about Harry Styles. This one and I knew you were trouble. They're both about the same person, and there's a line, or there's a clue in like the, I don't know what do you call it, like the.
The liner notes or
yeah, the liner notes or whatever that says this song also contains the lyrics "Won't Stop to Surrender," which is something Harry Styles has tattooed on him.
So. Ah, okay. All right.
Yeah.
A little dig there. In some investigation into that, it seems to me Harry was like, whatever, fuck it. Like he was almost like he's handled this better than most of the men that get dissed on any of the songs we've covered so far, he's been like, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Funny. Anyways, I like this one a lot, too. The next one of the big hits, one of the singles off the album, I Knew You Were Trouble. Disco guitar is fucking back, baby. I love the beat here. It's choppy, fun, thick, like disco guitar mixed with synth drums and piano leading up to the chorus. And then out of nowhere, you get this build up to a bass drop, and it hits like a fucking sledgehammer, dude. That bass drop is awesome. This is the mark of her new era. This is the first moment where she's transformed from era one to era two, whatever they label these eras. I have no fucking clue. But this is era two, track one.
Yeah.
And I love it. She does great work on the mic here, too. Confident, strong, strutting, works through the whole range. Great track.
You know what's funny on this one? Is Taylor said she originally wrote this on the piano and imagined it as like a slow ballad. And working with different producer or whatever, they're like, nah.
What if we punched it up to 11?
What if we made it like a pseudo EDM song? You know what's funny? I do like this song. This was one that got absolutely overplayed on the radio.
So yeah, 100%.
It's kind of...
In hindsight, I've appreciated more. But I remember being in middle school probably when this album came out and being like, oh, fucking hell, man.
Yeah, it was just one of those ones where like you heard it too many times. But it is a good song.
Yeah.
And it is catchy. And this is the other one that was allegedly about Harry Styles.
Yeah. Dig it. Track five. This is... Something All Too Well. So she said, before I get into it, she said in some interview after this came out, or maybe it was just like a preamble to a bit at one of her shows, where she was like, you know, I have this song and this album Red, All Too Well. It's very personal to me. It's very, you know, different than some of the other stuff on the album that's fun and dancey. And, you know, I really like this song. This is my favorite song on the album. I didn't think anybody else would really love this song the way I do.
Yeah, because it's so personal.
And as the years have gone along, it's really struck me how much my fans love this song as much as I do, and I'm just touched by that. And it is everything that Dear John is, almost equally. Well, you could argue equally as well. It's not quite as biting and, like, menacing as Dear John. But it's equally like, what the fuck were you thinking, Jake Gyllenhaal?
I think it's more biting, to be honest.
You think so?
Yeah, because this is the part where you're looking back and, like, I think it's much more personal. Like, talking about, like, leaving her scarf there, and I think it's much more relatable in that sense.
Yeah, yeah, it's a bit... I think in both songs, she leads the song off as, like, hey, things were going good, and then...
I think the pain is much more prominent in this song compared
to...
Yeah, I do.
See, that's the argument. Like, I would put those two songs up against each other, and I think it's a fair discussion to have, to be like, which one's more powerful? Which one's more this, that, the other? Maybe you're right. Maybe giving this... So this is like a five-minute song on the original production of this album.
Yes.
The original version of this song, which she made in the studio way back when but was dissuaded from doing, is like a 10-minute version of this song. And it gets put out on the re-release on the Taylor's version.
Yes.
And the 10-minute version is so much better.
Well, you know what's crazy? So, like, the 5-minute version has 210 million streams from Taylor's version. The 10-minute version has 800 million streams.
It's massive, dude. And it's this just, like, full symphony. By the end, you're, like just struck. It's very much Kashmir or Stairway to Heaven in the power that it brings.
I think that's, yeah, the power of the storytelling and just the build up.
Yeah, and this chorus is so catchy and correct, or I guess authentic maybe is the better word. Biting, again, very much like Dear John, where it like hits the nail right on the head. And I totally understand where the critical acclaim for this song comes from. Because it's everything you want in a Taylor Swift, like, diss track.
Yeah, this is, I mean, it's a fantastic song. Each chorus, like, she changes up some of the lyrics a little bit, which is nice. I always like when an artist does that well.
Agreed.
And just, like, the power in the lyrics. Time won't fly. It's like I'm paralyzed by it. I'd like to be my old self again, but I'm still trying to find it. After plaid shirt days and nights when you made me your own, now you mail back my things and I walk home alone. but you keep my old scarf from that very first week because it reminds you of innocence and it smells like me. You can't get rid of it because you remember it all too well.
And so there's a so this is at the scarf's at Maggie Gyllenhaal's house. Who knows if it's still there or not?
Is that his sister?
Yeah, Maggie Gyllenhaal. She's an actress too.
Gotcha.
She's been asked about this a couple times. One time she got asked about it on Andy Cohen, and she basically said, like, oh, I don't know. Maybe. It might be there. I haven't looked. Shut the fuck up.
You know.
You know.
You know.
When this came out, you were like, where's that fucking scarf? You know. Don't be. What are you hiding? What are you hiding? Yes, I have the scarf. Actually, I nailed it to the wall. Like, dude, if that scarf ever.
You got to wait. You know what she's doing? She's probably waiting to sell it for $1 million.
I was just about to say, that is going to take Kurt Cobain's guitar from Live and Unplugged and make it look like a fucking knickknack.
I don't know if we're the first person to think of this, but that's what's happening with the scarf. It's just waiting to get sold for a massive amount of money.
I mean, maybe upwards of $10 million wouldn't shock me.
Do you think – now, here's a question. I was thinking about this earlier today. Do you think when Jake Gyllenhaal was mailing back her stuff that it was a conscious effort of, oh, I'm going to keep the scarf? Or he was just like, forgot about it and then was like, well, I'm not going to send another shipment of things just to send the scarf back.
Yeah, so I guess the implication on this track is that he kept it on purpose because he did ship all that shit back and the scarf wasn't in that shit.
Right, and that's
so why are you keeping it, Jake? Did it really get stuck in a drawer at Maggie's house and you just forgot about it? Maybe, maybe not. Do I think he did it on purpose? I actually lean to agree yes.
Oh, you think he did?
Yes. Because then, right, if you truly did forget, and then you're like, oh, the scarf's actually in the drawer, are you not, like, like getting rid of it as soon as possible?
So I guess my question then is that, like, how the story goes is that he found the scarf in the drawer and then still kept it?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, I don't know much about Jake Gyllenhaal's personal life, but it doesn't seem crazy to imagine that, like, something as innocuous as a scarf might be kept behind as a sort of memento of a tumultuous but important relationship in your life.
See, I don't know. I would tend to lean in the – and this might be because I'm a huge Jake Gyllenhaal fan.
I am too. I love him.
Yeah, can we just – he's a good-looking guy.
He's a great-looking actor.
But on the reverse of that, he was dating her when she was 21 and he was 28 or 29 or something like that. Kind of creepy.
It's a little crazy. It's not
creepy.
That crazy.
I don't know. I just – I it's hard for me to imagine him sitting there going through her shit, putting it all in a box, seeing the scarf, taking it out of the box. You know what I'm saying? Like, him to look at it and be like – oh, it still smells like her.
Well, I don't think it's like that. I think she makes it sound like that. I don't think it's like that, although maybe Jake's a freak. I don't know.
I think it's more likely that he puts all the shit in the box, sends it to her, and she goes, where's my scarf? And he goes, what scarf?
It would be hilarious if he had sent the scarf, and she was like, oh, fuck you, I'm writing this anyways.
Oh, yeah, that would be funny.
That would have been funny, yeah. But yeah, I don't know.
Skartgate or Scarfgate.
Oh man, what a fucking guy!
I mean,
and he got dragged. He got dragged when this album came out. He got dragged again when the re-release came out.
I actually think he handled it well too. I didn't see anything. The only thing I saw from him was like, yeah, people are gonna express themselves how they want. I just wish that if someone's getting dragged online, then like maybe you could tell people to not drag. Like he basically just said like, tell the army to stop coming after me because I have to like I have to turn off
I have
all my
to
comments.
Live. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
But I think he handled everything well.
I think he did too. Honestly, like I remember not seeing a response and being like, yeah, that's fine.
Also, side note, have you seen Prisoners?
No,
dude, it's one of my top 5-10 favorite movies of all time. Jake Gyllenhaal, Hugh Jackman.
One of my cult classic favorites of all time is The Source Code with Jake Gyllenhaal.
Oh, dude. That's a – you know what's funny? I just watched that within the last, like, 2 years.
A little cult classic. It's kind of a campy movie, but the twist at the end is wild, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember seeing that in the theaters and being like, whoa, this is Inception 2.
Yeah, he's a fantastic actor.
He was great in Spider-Man. He was –
Spider-Man?
Yeah, he was Mysterio in the Spider-Man movie.
Oh.
The second one. Not the most recent one. Yeah. He was really good in that role. Obviously, Brokeback Mountain's been critically acclaimed. Yeah, really good actor.
Yeah.
All right, I think that's all I got for All Too Well right now.
Yeah, we might have just done 10 minutes on longer than the actual song.
And something I wanted to bring up, because I think now is maybe a good time to talk about it, is kind of a question that I was thinking about as I listened to this a few times. Is like, this album does not care to stick to any one sound or genre. And I think about some other artists that we've talked about. We've expressed a desire for some of our favorite artists to kind of bend the genres a little bit. Do something else. Mix in other elements. And I think I've been a little bit kind of like stubborn about it and been like, no, I like the fastball. I like the hamburger. But it is an interesting point when you see something like this work like this and you're like, to what extent is genre even like a useful tool in describing an artist? Right? Because like there are plenty of artists who fall into a very solid genre that I very much enjoy, and there are other artists who don't really fall into any one genre that I also enjoy, whether it's 21 Pilots, Post Malone. You know, there's some other ones that I can't think of off the top of my head, but like Foo Fighters did a bunch of different shit. And it's like, you know, genre is great for putting you on a certain radio station, but do I really give a fuck what radio station my favorite artists are on?
No,
not really. And so for the average listener, I don't know how great, like, I don't know how important it is to, like, put your favorite artists in their box. Like Beyonce, we talked about it on the last episode. Beyonce's doing the same thing where she puts out a country album, and somebody had asked her about it recently in an interview, and she said, or she, I think she tweeted out, like, hey, guys, I'm putting out an album. It's not a country album. It's a Beyonce album.
Mm.
To make the point that, like, yes, it's country music, but, like, it's really just, like, my music. This is – and it's a blend of country, too. It's a blend of country and R&B and some other elements that it doesn't neatly fit into the box. And does it even matter if it fits in the box? I don't know. I think that's something that the music industry has pushed for a long time because of radio play. That's how they made their money. That maybe is a little bit more accessible now to blend.
Yeah, I think it's starting to matter less and less to have – your music fit into one or two clean boxes.
Right, because at this point, like, yes, it would be strange to hear Beyonce on a country station, but I wouldn't be, like, if it's a good song, I wouldn't be aghast to be like, what is Beyonce doing on country radio?
Yeah.
You know, it's the same thing. God, we talked about somebody else that had this problem, and I'm forgetting who it was now, but, like, there are artists who struggle, especially early in their career, who struggle to find, like, a clean box to fit into. But more and more as we go along, like, it doesn't really matter.
No.
And
it's cool because when you do mix up your genres, like, different styles of music, and you do it right, there's nothing better.
It's the best, dude. Like, yeah. I think about, like, party country, like, country rock party songs, where it doesn't really fit into one or the other quite perfectly, but it's still fucking, like a, God, who would be, like, a Brantley Gilbert, or... I don't know. That's a good one. Jason Aldean kind of does it sometimes, too, where it's, like, very rocky. But it's also, it's a very clearly a country song.
Yeah.
But does it really matter? I don't know. Just
yeah. And to go back to, we were talking about Mac Miller earlier, like, going from, like, a frat rap album to, like, a more R&B with a little bit of rap, like, it's a different genre of music, but it works. And when the artist successfully pulls that off, it's, like, extra satisfying because you know they took the risk and you're reaping the reward.
And maybe Taylor's, well, no. Actually, as I think about it, the first example I can think of this is Run DMC and Aerosmith doing Walk This Way.
Got it. We got a shout out. I know he's a enemy of the show, but Rick Rubin helped get that set up.
Was he involved in that?
Yeah.
Hey, you know what?
Got to give him his flowers on that one.
Good work, buddy. That was a hit.
Yeah.
That's the first example I can think of it. But then, like, thinking to Linkin Park, where they're like really the first mainstream artist that does it really, really well. And from that time, you started to see more and more of it. And I really enjoy when artists in one, I hate to say this, but like artists in one genre collab with an artist in a different genre. Sometimes that works awesome. We talked about the Fall Out Boy Taylor Swift song last episode. It's a really cool song. I wish it was more pop punky, but like it's cool to have that. She's got a collab with Brendan Urie. She does Chris Stapleton on this album.
Yeah, that song. I like that song a lot.
Like, I love this. I'm starting to fall more and more in love with this genre blending thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important point here just because this album does it so much.
It does it well, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the next song.
So, yeah, so then we get into this next song, 22, which is this funny fusion where, like, the riff on this song is a very jangly country riff, but it's also...
It's also rooted in pop.
It's boosted up by these thick, pumping, like, pop drums, EDM drums, synth drums. And it's got this very dancey, like, super girl power vibe to it. And as it goes along, it turns into more of, like, a dance, like, kind of pop disco, or not disco, but, like, dance track. And then you go back to that country riff again, and it, back and forth. And, again, it's this really cool blend of the two sounds that it's not necessarily for me, and given, like, you know, I'm not 22 anymore, you're not 22 anymore, but it's so relatable.
Oh, for sure. And this is one, like, in the right setting, like, I really enjoy this song. It's a fun part.
I think this is something I would listen to in the car by myself and be like, yeah, this is a cool song. But I would never go to the pool and be like, hey, guys, coming up next. You might.
I might.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways, that's not to take away from the song. It's just to say it's a little bit more rooted in like a girly type of vibe that it just isn't for me.
Yeah.
But it's still a really good song.
Still a great song, just even though you're not necessarily sure what path you're on in life, knowing that you're just going to have a good time and, you know, feel young and have a good time for that night.
Right. 100%. Yeah.
The next song is another powerful, powerful song, I Almost Do.
Yeah, country-style ballad here. It sounds like there's a couple guitars going, but they play on top of each other so precisely in parts that it's like kind of hard to even hear the two things going on at once. But they're in different tunes, so you can kind of – there are moments where you like hear it and you're like, oh, is that two of them? And maybe I'm just imagining that, but that's what it sounded like to me. Energetic, kind of loving vocals and a decent pace here. There's even a little guitar solo kind of in the bridge, like a little acoustic guitar, kind of a few licks. It also struck me that this song, I feel like this might have been something that Hayley Williams had her fingers in, because lyrically it sounds very much like a Paramore song that was repurposed for Taylor Swift.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
I'll pull up the lyrics here in a second, but, like, especially towards the end of the track, I was like, huh.
Well, I think, to me, this is very much her reflecting on her relationship with, you know, with JKG and the conflict you have when, you know, you kind of want someone back, want to give it another try, but at the same time, you know you can't do that because you're going to get hurt even more if you do. The thing that I found interesting about this song was it's kind of the same message and same thinking as I Bet You Think About Me with Chris Stapleton. And she even uses some of the same metaphors, talking about, like, I bet you're sitting in their chair thinking about, you know, whatever.
That's what I was going to right now. So the last four lines in the song, I bet you're tired from a long, hard week. I bet you're sitting in your chair by the window, looking out at the same city or at the city. And I hope sometimes you wonder about me. I don't know. That just strikes me as very Hayley. Very like, yeah, you wish you were with me still, but you're not. That's also very Taylor, but, like, I don't know. It struck me that way. Maybe I'm conflating two things that don't exist, but.
No, I could see that. But it is cool, like, going back to the comparison with I Bet You Think About Me, it's essentially the same thought process and the same, like, it's the same type of song, but, like, with a different attitude about it.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, which is cool.
No, I like it, too. Great, great ballad on this one. All right, one of the other hits off this album, singles off this album, We Are Never, Ever Getting Back Together. This is another one I might listen to the car by myself.
This is another one that is good, but it was, like, way too overplayed on the radio.
Yeah, overplayed on the radio and very, like, very female-oriented.
The line in the song where she says, you know, I bet you found some indie record much cooler than mine is hysterical, thinking about Jake Gyllenhaal showing a young Taylor Swift an indie record and being like, yeah, you know, the stuff you're listening to is all right, but check out this.
Have you heard of the 1975?
He pulls out the Lumineers' first album.
Oh, man. And she's just sitting there, like, kind of, like, confused, like, what are you doing right now? You know I make music, too, right?
Yeah, that's the funny part is Jake Gyllenhaal thinking that he has better music than Taylor Swift.
Dude, the other line in this song that makes me laugh, or I guess it's a couple lines, but the spoken bit in the bridge where she's talking to somebody either on the phone or like in person, it's just like, oh, this guy just keeps calling, and I'm like, oh, we are never, ever getting back together. From what I've gathered, it sounds like that was a recording of her talking to somebody in the studio about it and just like getting her frustrations out. That was a very like authentic line. It wasn't like purposed for the song, and it just fit here. It makes me laugh every time I hear it. And I think it's a great, because right after that, she breaks right back into that like powerful chorus and kills it.
Yeah, definitely. No, another hit off the album. It's in the right setting. You might catch me listening to it by myself as well.
Fun dance track. The next one, I think, is the most underrated song on the album.
Oh,
really? Stay. She breaks out a ukulele for this one, and it's got this fast, kind of choppy, bright riff, fun, amused vocals. Telling the story of this guy she's dating that's like kind of a dunce, a bit of an airhead, but in a fun way. Like her frustrations kind of amuse him. And he's not like a jerk. He's just, you know, he's not some intellectual, and he's not taking things too seriously. He kind of lets it bounce off of him. And I think it kind of like cracks her up too, kind of looking back on it. Like, yeah, I would get mad and say things to him and this and that. And he was kind of like, ah, that's cool. it's just a fun, really fun track. There's little bright hits of keyboard here and there, well, like mixed in. Great deep cut.
Yeah, it's funny. It's catchy. I didn't like this one as much as you did, but it's not bad.
Yeah, I hear you. And, you know, certainly, like, it's fairly simple musically, but it's full also, I'll say.
Yeah, the next one, I for some reason, I wasn't really a big fan of it. The Last Time, featuring Gary Lightbody of Snow Patrol.
Yeah, there's something about this one that I, like...
Underwhelming, kind of?
I don't get it. Like, this should be something that I enjoy, but I just, like, am still, maybe it's still growing on me or something. Because he does have a very different, it's water and vinegar a little bit. He's got this very, like, bassy, deep voice, and she's more up in her high range on this one. You know, the beat here is kind of built with violin and strings instruments, and they keep rising and rising as the energy goes. And it's a beautiful kind of crescendo again, like a longer track. They have their own verses. They duet. They go on top of each other. I don't know why this one doesn't like strike me hard, but it just doesn't.
You know, it's funny with out of this one, the Ed Sheeran one and the Chris Stapleton one. Actually, both the Ed Sheeran ones. I like the Chris Stapleton one. I find the Ed Sheeran one and this one pretty underwhelming. I know a lot of people like it, but I guess it's just not for me.
I think I'm in agreement with you there. Like, it's not something I dislike. I just, there's something about it that doesn't strike me hard.
It just feels like it with those two artists, and same with Ed Sheeran, like, it has potential to be better, and maybe they just don't make the song I want them to make together.
Yeah, maybe that's it. I think I like the Ed Sheeran one a little bit more than you, and we'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah.
But there's just something like intangible missing here. Alrighty, next one, Holy Ground. Another kickback to the country fans. Still like kind of a pop country rock blend where you get drums and keyboard poppy on this, but then you get this like kind of ringing, buzzy electric that builds like a country kind of country rock sound to it. Belts out her lines the whole way through. Very powerful vocals. And a good mix, a good blended kind of genre song here. I like this one too.
Yeah, there's some good storytelling in this song about falling for someone. It's all right. Not necessarily my cup of tea. The song's hidden message is when you came to the show in San Diego, which leads to the assumption that it was Joe Jonas.
Still doing this? Okay, come on, get over it. We've been cooking him for 3 albums now. Relax.
Yeah,
it would be a funny that she didn't do it. And obviously the time has passed, but a funny alternate art for these albums would have just been like pictures of the guys she's absolutely dragging on some of like the main songs.
That's
like
a great idea.
Like a picture, an old picture of her and Jake together would have been fucking hilarious as an alt art cover for this album.
Or like a crude drawing that kind of looks like them, but you can't tell, just to avoid any lawsuits.
Almost like stick figures.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly stick figures and like crayon hair and whatever.
Just a thought, Taylor. Think about it. Anyways. All right, next one. Sad, Beautiful, Tragic. It's the first one I didn't really care for.
I didn't like this one.
It's just not my style of music. It's very much like Sad Girl Summer vibes.
Yeah.
Heartbreaking acoustic ballad. You know, it's a similar thing musically to All Too Well, where it's got this very generic like acoustic strumming mixed in with a lick here and there, but much more beat up, much more dejected. You know, I guess if I was like heartbroken, maybe this is something, but yeah, not for me.
Yeah, songs about appreciating something like a relationship that's over. Just because it's over doesn't mean it wasn't beautiful, but yeah, not for me as well. The next one is The Lucky One, which I didn't really like this one either.
Huh. How do I do this here? I kind of like this one. Synth drums are like crushing here. You get these shuffly hi-hats. I think they're synth. Making up the majority of this beat, kind of mixed in with piano and acoustic hits. It's almost got this like marching band sound to it. Vocals really build up to a powerful like symphony of one, where it sounds like she's layering and layering and layering, and like all of a sudden it's just very full. You know, very raw, very biting. A good little dig here. I kind of like this one. But I no doubt, like, I'm not going to argue, like, I'm not going to fight to the death over it. It's no hill to die on.
Yeah. The next song, Everything Has Changed, featuring Ed Sheeran. This is one of the hits off the album, but I don't know. For some reason, I'm not a fan of this one.
I don't know. I think Ed's actually good in his verse. I don't like the duetting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he's good. I think he's really good on his verse. And it's funny because, like, so the Gary Lightbody song, The Last Time, it's strange to have your guest vocalist open the song. You know, like, how many guest vocalists are on the first verse of the track, especially a male vocalist on a female artist?
Yeah, good point.
It's strange. Like, you hear the song, you're like, the fuck is this? This is a Taylor Swift song? But anyways, that's not the case on this track. She does the first one, he does the second one, and they do a lot of duetting in the choruses. I like the riff here. It sounds like Ed's playing the guitar because he's got that very like Ed Sheeran kind of poppy sound to it. Synth drums and, you know, a little bit of the like EDM elements to it. Like I said, he's really smooth on his verse, not rushing through it. Like, think of some Ed Sheeran songs where he's kind of got like that flowy thing to it. He doesn't really rush it. It's just right in line with the music, and kind of wraps himself up in it. And, you know, I like I said, not a huge fan of the duetting on the chorus, but I think their individual verses are really good.
Yeah, the song is about realizing your life is flipped upside down after falling for someone new. The funny thing on this song is it's allegedly about Connor Kennedy, who is RFK Jr.'s kid. But it's just funny, when I went to look him up, the only two things I could find were that he was RFK's son and that he dated Taylor Swift. There's like nothing else about him.
Yeah, there's a much better song about Connor Kennedy in the bonus tracks that we'll talk about a little bit. But it is funny, in her catalog of ex-boyfriends, to have Connor Kennedy there.
Yeah, wild card.
Just out of nowhere.
Yeah, we got so Harry Styles, Jake Gyllenhaal, John Mayer, Joe Jonas, and then Connor Kennedy.
Out of the clouds. there's a funny thing where she was dating this guy for a little while, and she ended up buying the house in the Hamptons right next door to the Kennedy's estate there. And then they broke up, and she just, like, almost immediately sold the house.
Smart.
Yeah, like, oh, this is the house Taylor Swift lived in? $5 million. but, yeah, anyways, funny little story there. Cool song. Next one, Starlight. It's back to more of that pop sound, kind of cool pop rock, dancey track, thumping electric chords and higher-level vocals with a simple kick drum. I think the range here is great, especially their lines in the bridge, really working up into that higher level. musically, she's got some, like, Weezer to this song. It's a little bit Beverly Hills. It's a little bit like, what's that song on the first one? Anyways, it'll come to me. Not Pink Triangle, but a couple before that. Regardless, like, early Weezer I got in this track for some reason. Regardless, cool dance track, but not great.
Yeah, it's kind of catchy. Funny enough, sticking with the Kennedys, she wrote this about after seeing a picture of Ethel and Bob Kennedy when they were 17. And that's where she's singing, I met Bobby on the boardwalk, summer of 45, picked me up late one night out the window. We were 17 and crazy, running wild. So, a couple of Kennedy tracks in a row here.
Yeah. Interesting she saved it for the end. I don't know why, but, like, You would think she would smatter them in, like, throughout, but she does Harry Styles, then she does Jake, then she does Connor. Maybe this is like a timeline thing, but
to me, this one, this track kind of seems like if you were gonna cut one more track from the original cut of the album, this would be the track I'd probably cut.
Or Sad, Beautiful, Tragic, but yeah.
Well, just in like the context of, I mean, I guess it is. It's still on the concept of love. If it's like if we're thinking of it from a broader concept, but it's just a random song about the Kennedy. Like I don't know.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's a strange ad.
It doesn't have
this album is so personal.
Yeah,
but it's
yeah,
strange
yeah.
to have this here.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Last track on the original version of this album, Begin Again. And this is a country style ballad through and through. Plucky, bright acoustic, with little licks over it here and there. Piano adding some bass and heaviness to it. Even got some like quiet, subtle banjo mixed in. Vocals are all over the place. She doesn't really get too high, but other than that, like she does great work in her lower range on this song. Quieter, lower, like not biting, but like a little bit heavier stuff here. But then she's also got these airy, very like easy breezy lines too, where she goes back and forth. And I one of her better songs on the mic on this album, in my opinion. And I think it's a great closer and a fun little last dig at Jake Gyllenhaal, maybe.
Well, it also ends the album on an optimistic note, or more of an optimistic note. So I think it's good in its spot as a closer. I'm not going to come back to this one a lot, but it's in the context of the album, it's fine.
Yeah, I think I agree with you there. So bonus tracks. Let's talk bonus tracks. I said to you before the episode, I don't know if all the bonus tracks are hits, but there's a few I'd like to discuss.
Same. Let's start with The Moment I Knew, which is a song about Jake Gyllenhaal missing her 21st birthday party.
Yeah.
Which is when she knew that it wasn't going to work out. He was promoting one of his movies at the time. I mean,
what's the,
I don't know. I'm kind of,
who's at fault here?
Kind of see both sides of the story. He's an A-list actor. He needs to promote the movie. Like, could he have caught a flight and made it? I don't know.
This is one of those things to me where maybe it was like, hey, Taylor, listen, I'm going to be out of town this day. Like, could you do another day? And she's like, but it's my 21st. And he was like, well, I'm going to be out of town. So whether or not you like it, I'm going to be out of town. She was like, fuck it, I'm doing it anyways. And then made it about him. I don't know. That might be the case. That might not be the case. But that's kind of where I lean.
Yeah. It's tough. It's like, you know, at the end of the day, I guess if Jake Gyllenhaal is putting work before her and she didn't like that, then I get it. But on the other hand, if you're
okay.
Like, it'd be like if her album's coming out and it's his 40th birthday or 30th birthday or whatever, and he's like, hey, like, I don't know.
Maybe this comes from a bit of a place of still growing and not being fully mature yet, too, where you're like, this is a big fucking day, but you're dating an adult who's like, work comes first, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say my 21st birthday party, well, it's just, I guess it's what it means to you. I went out with like 4 friends and I could care less.
Well, mine was on a Tuesday, so I did a similar thing.
Yeah,
you know?
Like, I already had alcohol, so I just went out to the bar with a couple friends, got a couple drinks, and that was it.
Yeah, and, you know, I could see how this is a big day for somebody. I get it. But, yeah, like, to what extent does work not come, especially not being married? Like, you're not married. You're not engaged, even. Like, to what extent does your work come before, like, not come before your relationship?
There might just be differences with celebrities where it's like they have enough money to fly wherever they need to fly. So
yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah, you can come back for the night.
Anyways, I think we're both kind of on the same page here.
Yeah.
Another one I wanted to talk about, maybe I'm skipping past a few of yours, maybe not. Ronin.
Yep.
This is a crazy track. Kind of out of nowhere. Like, I heard this, I was like, whoa, where is this coming from? And she tells this, like, sad, incredible story, and beautifully written, too, about a 4-year-old who's looking into his mother's eyes and seeing, like, or maybe it was a her, I don't know, I think it was a him.
No, it was a him.
And, you know, just seeing the love and the joy in this 4-year-old's eyes, who was, you know, his life was tragically taken by, you know, terminal disease, terminal illness.
Type of cancer, yeah.
And, you know, she just goes on, and it gets sadder and sadder and sadder. And it's fucking heartbreaking listening to it. Like, and it doesn't really fit with the album. It's a great bonus track. Great, great, great bonus track. And it's not a personal story to Taylor, except that it was kind of written and posed to Taylor. And she was like, you know what? That's so beautiful. I'm going to take this on. And I this is an absolute must listen on the list. Like, if you're gonna give this top to bottom, absolute must listen.
Yeah, it's a sad song. Definitely makes you emotional. And the mom of Ronan, you know, got a co-writing credit on the song and helped write it with Taylor. And yeah, it's just a very gripping and emotional song.
Yep. So I wanted to talk about that one.
I want to talk real quick, Better Man. So
she had the opportunity to do the funniest thing ever with this track.
Oh.
Pearl Jam cover would have been fucking hilarious.
Dude, yeah, I did think that when I saw the song title. I was like, oh, I wonder if it,
never in a million years, but it would have been funny.
But you know what's funny about this one is that she actually gave this song to Little Big Town, and they made it a hit in 2016. So
and then she did her version on the bonus, yeah.
And it's funny because it's, you know, it's more rooted in country than pop, per
se. Yeah, 100%. Yep.
And then Little Big Town ended up winning a Grammy for this.
Oh, sweet.
Which is, it's funny that it's like, it's not even their song.
Yeah.
And then Babe, which is another one of the bonus ones, she gave to Sugarland in 2018.
I wasn't a huge fan of this one. This one got old quickly.
Yeah, they did play it on the radio a lot. But
not even that. Just like the lyrics here, the repetitive Babe. Like,
well, it's just funny that she's got two.
Yeah, yeah.
These are big hits,
mm-hmm.
like for these other artists. And yeah. She's just like, yeah, here, I got enough.
You can have my scraps. And those are also Grammy worthy. Funny. As we go along here, I think the next one is it? I bet you think about me.
With Chris Stapleton?
Yeah, with Chris Stapleton.
I like that song a lot.
It's crazy. This is maybe the first one I've noticed. I can't remember now, but it's got like prominent loud harmonica in it. And the harmonica very much plays the Piano Man Billy Joel riff. It sounds so much like it. It's a little bit like whinier, a little bit more. It's not as clean as the Billy Joel version, but it sounds awesome. And Chris Stapleton on this track fucking rocks, just in his deep, kind of low, heavy Chris Stapleton sound. I think this is a great duet between them.
You 100% agree with all that. You know what would be funny is some of the lyrics in this song are, at your cool indie music concerts every week, I bet you think about me in your house with your organic shoes and your $1 million
couch.
Yeah,
that's funny. Yeah.
Like, if Jake Gyllenhaal just came out and he was like, actually, I don't think about you at all.
Well, no, this is about Connor Kennedy, no?
No, I think this one's, well, I don't know. I thought this one was about Jake.
Maybe. I could see both, but it struck me as a Connor Kennedy track.
Well, no, just because the indie music was mentioned in the earlier
Silver
track.
Spoon, $1 million couch, da da da. Like,
true.
Could be either, but regardless, whoever it's at, oof, that's a tough one.
The organic shoes is hilarious.
That was a funny fucking line.
Do they even? They don't even make those.
No, that's the point. Yeah, that's the point. Oh, dude, what a great duet here. I can't believe this didn't make the original version of the album.
Yeah, this is a great track.
Especially, like, I don't know if she had Chris Stapleton on the original version, but if she did and she was holding on to it, wow.
I don't know. That would have been, I think Chris Stapleton came out with his first album a little bit later, but he was also writing music, so who knows? I don't know.
Who knows, but regardless, great ad there. Great fucking call, Taylor.
Yeah.
Other than that, like, the other ones, nothing really stood out to me. Like I said, the very last track on this album is the All Too Well 10-minute version. We talked about it already. Fantastic. Must listen.
Yeah, I had mentioned this when we talked about the shorter version, but do you think Jake just forgot to mail the scarf back?
Crazy.
What if UPS lost it?
That's such a weird thing to do. So, yeah, and then she's got that note at the end that I already talked about, and I think that's a cool little thing to have on albums. I like, usually, like, the only one that we've talked about that I didn't love was the Buble Christmas.
Oh, yeah. In the I guess album commentary is separate, but yeah.
Yeah, that's a whole different thing. This is more just a final piece for the fans. And I like it. It's cool.
Yeah.
So that's Red by Taylor. Powerful, kind of momentum-shifting album. And we've said a lot of great things about it. I don't want to repeat myself, but really, really cool work. We're moving into a period of Taylor's discography, let's say, that is going to be a little bit more adverse to us, I think.
Yeah.
A little bit, well, not a little bit, like much, much poppier, much more.
Yeah, because what's the next album?
1989.
Okay.
And, you know, there's going to be some good stuff and some stuff that just isn't for us on those, I think. I think country is very accessible for us. I think pop is a little bit more hit and miss for us.
Yeah, Bad Blood, Shake It Off, Blank Space. That's right. Very, very poppy.
Right. So, you know.
I do like New Romantics, though.
Yeah, and I'm not saying it's bad music. I'm just saying there's going to be a little bit more bumps in the road as we go here. And that's not saying that it's bad music. I'm just saying it's not necessarily our cup of tea.
Yeah.
But I'm excited. That's part of why we're doing this. It's interesting to look at that and see what it is. So, yeah, that's all I got for Red.
Alrighty.
Cool. All right, guys. So next week, so this will probably be coming out in a couple weeks, but it doesn't matter at this point. Like by this point in the episode, it really doesn't matter. After this, we got.
Oh yeah,
so
we didn't say it on Vance Joy, but that's okay.
No. So after Vance Joy, after Taylor, we're going to All American Rejects, and then we're doing. What are we doing after that?
We're gonna do Jet.
Jet, and then
Audioslave.
Right? Audioslave, yeah. Thank you very much. Which are probably, it's going to be the majority of the rock we do for a little while. Because I think by the time we get over with Audioslave, it's going to be time to get into a little country, get into a little like funner kind of summer music. We'll still definitely mix in rock for sure. And I know you've got a lot of rock artists you want to cover. So we'll definitely be mixing in the rock. But I think since you've got a list of four or five artists you want to hit to.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to mix in some different stuff, and we'll go from there. So,
I like that.
All right. That's all we got this week. Thanks for listening. Follow us on socials, Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, and TikTok at Flip the Record. Like, review, subscribe on Apple. Thanks for listening.
Catch you on the next one.
Marathon.
At some point.